Thank you. The format of this meeting is two 10-minute speakers, followed by a main speaker. Speakers, please note you will be given 5-minute and 1-minute reminders when it is time to wrap up your talk. Our first 10-minute speaker is Cassie S.
Hi, everybody. Cassie Alcoholic. That is an honor and a privilege to speak at our home group, and I want to thank Marty for asking me. I really do want to thank him. I'm nothing snarky. My sobriety date is August 5th, 2011, and you guys are my home group. I drank my whole life. Alcohol is just a humongous part of my existence from the time I was, from as long as I can remember. My dad was a heavy drinker. His whole family were. We celebrated everything with alcohol. There's pictures of me with a highball glass in my hand from every family party from the age of 12 on. And I look like I'm having a good time, and I am. I mean, with my family, that was how we celebrated each other. That was it. That was in my dad's sister's house, you drank. And it felt like a birthright to me. But when I started drinking in a way that started sucking the life out of me, I always say it was in my 20s, but it started when I was 18. Because when I was 18, I left home and had no filter and had to be my own person out there in the world. I was so, a lifetime of anxiety and discomfort and dislike of myself and disbelief in myself and an inability to just be a person in the world and interact with other humans, made alcohol a necessity. It was no longer the thing I did to enjoy my family or enjoy myself. It was a thing I had to have as a lubricant before I could introduce myself to you, before I could stand in front of you, before I could, you know, have any kind of comfort or peace in my head. It became my sleeping pill really early on. By the time I was 21, I was working in law firms where in the 80s, when outside issues that made you really speedy were a big, big part of my job. And, everybody drank like I drank, and nobody was telling me there was anything wrong with it yet. And I really thought that like alcohol was the thing that made everything okay. You know, I liked the stuff that made me speedy because it usually made me skinny. But honestly, the thing I wanted, the thing I needed was the alcohol. And the thing I did sitting at home alone at night was the alcohol. And the thing that I never noticed when the change happened from when I had to drink to be out and about with you to the part where I just sat in my own house and drank to watch TV, to enjoy anything. If I was going to sit down to enjoy anything, then it really was like, oh, this will go so much better with a drink, which really meant a bottle. By the time I was in my mid-20s, I had, oh gosh, I didn't finish the school I went to. I didn't finish the career path I was trying for. I started working for lawyers. They paid me enough to enjoy my life, so I just kept doing that. Did that for decades. And I left Los Angeles because it seemed like it was the problem. And when I got out to San Francisco where I went, I found somebody who had a much worse addiction than me, I thought, and who looked really good on paper. So my mom was going to be happy. And since he was the person standing in the room when I turned 30 and he didn't seem to mind my drinking so much, I married him and we had a child, and that child turned out to be autistic, and he's amazing and super high functioning. But what he needed was a parent who was an advocate and present and, somebody who was pushing for him to get everything he needed in life. And that's exhausting, and it takes away my drinking time. So I didn't get to be the parent I wanted to be. I certainly wasn't the wife that anybody would deserve. And I decided that San Francisco and him was the problem, and I came back here. So I get back here, I'm 36, my son is 4. Now I haven't got him as an excuse, and I haven't got him as an audience. And I can drink the way I want to drink, and I can do it all the time. And I found some people who liked to do what I like to do and do it all night long, people I went to high school with, and we partied like rock stars for a while. And then even the people who were helping me get the outside issues were telling me, gee, you sure do like to drink a lot, or maybe you drink too much, or you seem to like this too much. And I thought, well, that's just rude. Why is my drug dealer complaining about my drinking? It's none of his damn business. I was so sure that I needed to keep my life to myself that I found after I got sober that I had been hiding bottles from me. Like, I lived just me and my son, and there were bottles hidden in shoes in my closet. Don't know who I was hiding them from. My son certainly didn't care. Those last 4 years of my drinking, every day looked the same. I don't have to tell you much about that, except that I sat down on my couch with a bottle of booze and a bag of food, and I didn't get up until it was 2011. And my mother begged me to go to a therapist. It was my 5,000th therapist. I've been to every kind of therapy known to man. I've gone to psychic therapist and Est and Marianne Williamson. I did everything I could to seek something to fill the hole that was inside of me. And I didn't want anyone to tell me that alcohol was hurting me, because I thought alcohol was filling that hole. I thought it was my solution. That therapist was the one who pulled the covers on me and told me I'd have to slow down on my drinking, and told me that water bottle on her desk that she thought was water, she knew wasn't. And if I didn't want to die, I probably should do something about this. And after many months of back and forth and trying to convince her I could do it on my own, I went into a detox. I went into a detox because Amy Winehouse died. I think I've told this story before. And the morning I heard she died, my first thought was, well, she was like 80 pounds wet. Of course she had this killed her. You know, I'll be fine. And I thought, did you just justify your drinking and the damage you're doing to your body by saying, you know, like, you're too big to die, you'll be okay? This is crazy. So I went to detox and I came out. I have been to AA many, many times. I was 18 years old when I walked into the Ohio Street the first time, so I always knew where it was. And when I got back to my office that Friday, that Saturday after detox, I had agreed to go to one meeting at the Marina Center that a woman inside the detox center set me up with a friend of hers. Didn't like it, didn't know anything about it, stood outside smoking the whole time. I've been to 100, probably about 50 AA meetings before this. That Monday night, I watched that parking lot at Ohio Street fill up like I always have, and I just said, okay, it's now or never, and I walked in there. And the first person I met was Mary Ann Kay, and she shook my hand. And I listened to Tim Hayes talk about his daughter at the meeting on Monday night, and he was talking about how important Mary Ann had been in her life because she remembered her name, and she made her feel welcome and warm. And it's exactly what Mary Ann did for me. She's always a part of my story, because I don't know that I'd still be here if somebody hadn't been that kind to me. And after her, she introduced me to Veronica and a couple other ladies, and they circled meetings in a book, and they did what we do. They did what now I know we're taught to do. They wouldn't let me leave. They wouldn't stop holding my hand. They wouldn't stop saying my name so that they could remember it, I think, and so that I would feel welcome. And that started happening to me in every room I walked into. I got blessed with a series of rooms full of women, especially, who just enveloped me with the program and their kindness, and with the understanding of one alcoholic talking to another. When I heard other women talk about all the things I had felt and thought, the first time I heard someone get up at the podium and talk about feeling like an alien as a child, I don't know how many women I've heard get up there and talk about how books were their first addiction. They used to disappear into fiction. That was me too. I'm just gonna say that 9 years later, I can't believe it's 9 years later. I had 27 years of my life where, with the few exceptions, I couldn't pass a day without drinking. And somehow, miraculously, coming here one day at a time, I don't drink. I don't wake up thinking about it. I don't go to sleep thinking about it. I live my life. I have amazing sponsees who are the most beautiful, sweet, lovely women, and they honor me with their time and they build my sobriety every single time I talk to them. And getting to be here amongst all of you has saved my life. So thank you.
Thank you, Cassie. Our second 10-minute speaker is Thomas C.
Hi, good evening. My name is Thomas and I'm an alcoholic. I want to thank Marty for asking me to participate in my sobriety with my home group. My sobriety date is May 15th of 2011. And I want to thank Kathy for her 10-minute share. She's a classmate of mine and it's great to be able to come onto this meeting like every week and see familiar faces and people that have been sober with me this whole entire time. I grew up on the mean streets of La Cañada, which is north of Glendale. And, you know, I grew up in an alcoholic home with two loving parents and an older brother. And, you know, I thought living in an alcoholic home was just normal. You know, it was like, it's like they say in the big book, it was like Jekyll and Hyde with my father growing up. Didn't really know what to expect. You didn't know if he was going to come home at night or if he was going to lose his car or if you're going to come home and see him crawling down the driveway or we're going to have a, you know, holiday event and he may go out to buy groceries and not come back with the turkey for Thanksgiving. You know, just we just like all these things would happen growing up and I thought that was just completely normal. Come to find out that, you know, that is not normal. Not everyone lives that way. My mother was also a rageaholic and she is qualifies in another 12-step program. So I grew up in a very kind of dysfunctional environment. Never really wanted to bring kids from school home because I didn't obviously know what to expect from, you know, my parents if they were going to be arguing or fighting or whatnot. And I got exposed to therapy and psychologists and whatnot early on because I, growing up, I had learning disability and I repeated second grade because I changed to a different school. And I ended up telling one of the psychologists that my father's drinking bothered me. And one of my mom's friends, because she was in another 12-step program, thought it would be a good idea for her to take me and my brother to preteen and Alateen. So I was exposed to the 12 steps and what we learn here early on, but that doesn't make me an alcoholic. Neither does, you know, growing up in an alcoholic home. But I knew exactly what alcoholism was early on. And I never really felt like I could relate with everyone. You know, I always felt a little bit different. It's not part of my story to be bullied and all of that. Most people were pretty nice to me growing up, but I just didn't feel the same. And I didn't feel like I was a part of, you know, so a little bit fast forward, you know, going into high school and whatnot, I ended up coming out in high school in my sophomore year of high school. And like I said, I grew up in a community that was somewhat accepting of me, but also there weren't a lot of people that were coming out in high school. And I ended up, you know, starting to hang out with different groups of friends. And I remember one of the first times I drank alcohol, we ended up in Pasadena and we were hanging out. And it was somewhere in Old Town. And we ended up going to like a local bar and somehow we were able to sneak into this like Irish bar of whatnot. And then somehow ended up getting people to buy us beer and whatnot. So we ended up going there and then somehow ended up at this park in Pasadena. And we went to a liquor store and they bought Cisco and a bunch of other alcohol, I think like Boone's Farm or like Fuzzy Navel or something. And I remember blacking out and somehow waking up in South Pasadena, which is somewhat close to Pasadena, but it's not close and we weren't driving. So how we ended up there, I have no idea. And then was behind some Ralph's supermarket in some alleyway. And that just kind of escalated into just, you know, a normal occurrence. It was always going out with different groups of friends and we started going to raves and going to clubs and I ended up getting my license and I was one of the first people in my class to get a license and, you know, thought it would be a good idea to drive to Tijuana with, you know, on a school night or go to, you know, Las Vegas. I mean, there was always some some kind of crazy situation that I was putting myself in. And on top of it, you know, my father's drinking was so out of control that my mother was not even aware of the fact that all this was going on, and neither was my brother, because he was in his own addiction as well. So what ended up happening was, is I would hang out with people, and I would have friends by the name of like Blow Pop, or, you know, Tigger or Cowboy. I'd have all these like random friends that would call the house, and you know, just crazy things. And I eventually ended up doing a geographic, because I was going out to clubs and different bars all over town. And we met these friends that were, my friend that I went to high school with, she was a dancer, and they thought it would be a good idea to go to Spain. So I ended up doing a geographic to Spain, and ended up finding out that these people that we were living with were con artists, and they were doing identity fraud, and they were doing all kinds of things. And one of the roommates, she ended up, she was a dominatrix in the middle of the night. The downstairs basement would turn into a dungeon, and there was all these crazy things happening. And the people that were taking our rent, because I ended up moving out of there once we found out these were the people I was hanging around with, he basically gave us an ultimatum saying that if we don't leave the country, that they'll report us, because we ended up robbing the neighbor's apartment by scaling the wall. It was like an 8-foot wall that we scaled. And so, you know, I could go on and on with all the crazy things that had happened, but I ended up with one of my lower companions and a friend. He actually asked me to go to a meeting with him, and I went to Colfax and Addison, and I dropped him off at this meeting. And the second time I drove him there, he said, well, why don't you come into the meeting and sit in the meeting? And I just heard the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. And this friend of mine is, I don't know if he's still sober, but with my ex-Eskimo getting me into the meetings, and this person went down a road that I could have completely gone down, you know, was in prison for many, many years and was doing all kinds of criminal activity. And I am blessed that I was not one of those people that got a DUI or arrested or any of that. I don't know how I was able to manage to not do that, but I ended up getting sober. And I have a lot of similarities to my story, kind of like Kathy was sharing, where I came to the Pacific Group, and one of the first people that I met, her name is Sherry, and Sherry R. came up to me at Rhonda's birthday party, I believe it was her 40th birthday party, and asked me, you know, how I was doing, and sat with me and talked with me and introduced me to my first sponsor. And, you know, basically shared, you know, their experience, strength, and hope with me, and welcomed me. And I became involved in Pacific Group, and I helped out at that party, and I, you know, cleaned up chairs and picked up trash and just did what we do here, and reached my hand out and got to know people. Even though it was scary, I just kept showing up. So if you're new, and, you know, there's nothing else that you get from my share, just keep showing up and just talk to people. Get a group of people that are your friends, and you know, go through the steps and take commitments, and you know, just do contrary action, things that are difficult, you know, things I didn't want to do, I just did them. And you know, I asked a new a old timer when I was new, you know, what do I need to change? And they said, you need to change everything. So, you know, that's something that I did, is I changed everything. I had to, you know, when I came in here, I was crawling on my hands and knees, you know, trying to figure out what I needed to do. I needed to learn how to go out and find a job, or how to pay a bill. You know, I used to just get bills in the mail, and I would throw them in a drawer. And, you know, now I've, you know, gone to finance class, and I've worked with sponsees, and I have current sponsees that call me and check in on me every day. And, you know, I'm current with my sponsor. And, you know, I've gone through a lot in sobriety. I've had, you know, I've had a loss in my family. My father passed away. And, you know, there's a lot of things in the big book about grieving and all of these things. And, you know, you can go through anything in sobriety. So that's all I have. So thanks for letting me share.
Thank you, Thomas. AA also has. Our main speaker tonight is Paul McHugh.
Hello, everyone. My name is Paul. I'm an alcoholic. And thank you so much for inviting me to your group. It's a great honor and a great privilege, and one I don't take lightly. And it was great to hear Cassie and Thomas. And I'm very nervous here. I'm almost as nervous as the time I actually spoke at the Pacific group. I think Julie was the chairperson that time, and she's explaining the different lights and the different minutes, and I got fixated on the lights, and I told somebody's story that night. I'm not really sure if it was mine, but I told somebody's story that night. So I hope I can make amends for that tonight, you know. And it was funny. It was my friend Bob's anniversary that night, Bob Z, and I'm sitting at the front, you know, and we're all bringing out the cake. I love cake, you know, and they kept putting the different candles on it and bring it up each celebrant, and they would blow all over the cake, and then the next person would blow all over the cake. And I'm like, man, I love sugar, but I'm not having any of that cake, you know. And I think by the end, one of the group members came along in a hazmat suit and a set of tongs and took the cake out. I think they're buried in the desert somewhere. It's still probably radioactive, you know. But so it was good to be with. So it's great to be here with you again tonight. And I would be remiss if I didn't offer my condolences to the group on the loss of your dear friend and founder, or one of the founders, Clancy Emerson. And I'm not going to say I knew Clancy very well. We met on many occasions. We had a mutual friend, John the Book from Belfast. And, you know, it was just a wonder. You know, when you meet Clancy, there was always usually a lot of people around, you know. But I remember one time we were in Las Vegas together, and he wanted to go to the Las Vegas Museum. And I said, I'll go with you. And it turned out we were just the two of us, and we spent the afternoon walking around the museum. And, you know, Clancy was a consummate storyteller, and he was just telling story after story, and I was just loving it, you know. And he would talk about, in his qualification, about golden memories, you know. And that's one of my golden memories, spending the afternoon with him at the Las Vegas Museum, being regaled by all these wonderful stories of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I know he's been asked to carry his light into a different room, boy, but did he leave a long shadow on this side of the curtain? And it says that, you know, if your memory is still alive, you're never really gone. And I think that is the case. And if that be the case, well, then Clancy will be with us for a long, long, long time, you know. So anyway, so I just thought I'd like to mention that, you know. And as I said, Derry, you know, it's great to be with you. And I love Alcoholics Anonymous. Here we are, you know, from all parts of the world. And I you know, socially distant but spiritually connected here in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm sitting in a little cubbyhole here in my living room. My youngest daughter, I have a two-year-old daughter. I know I don't look old enough to have a two-year-old daughter, but I have a two-year-old daughter and sleeping in the next room. So I'm sorry if this looks like a bit of a proof of life hostage video, you know. I should be holding up a copy of the New York Times to prove I'm still alive on a Wednesday, you know. But it's so good to be with you, you know. And James Joyce has got a great line from one of his books, and he's talking about Dublin, but it's so indicative of Alcoholics Anonymous. He says, here comes everybody. You look around, we're all here. Gender, color, creed. It doesn't matter. We're alcoholics together, you know. And because when you say the words terror, frustration, bewilderment, despair, every one of us identifies with that at some level, you know. When I heard the words pitiful, incomprehensible, demoralization, I didn't have to turn to the person next to me and go, what exactly does that mean? Oh, my goodness, it was the canopy under which I've been living a considerable portion of my life, you know. And here we are sitting in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. And Ernest Hemingway says that all writers tell the same story. And I think all alcoholics tell the same story. We all identify with each other, you know. Pain is the admission price of this new life, you know. And I don't know why I'm an alcoholic, you know. Is it nature? Is it nurture? Was that a symptom looking for disease? The big book of Alcoholics Anonymous says, we're not here to answer the riddle, you know. And that's so true, you know. You know, what's the old joke in Alcoholics Anonymous? You know, what came first, the chicken or the keg? You know, a lot of guys got drunk trying to figure that one out. I just accept the fact today that I'm an alcoholic. Everything I need to know, I found out at my first meeting. My name is Paul, and I'm an alcoholic. That tells me who I am, what I am, where I am, and what I need to be doing. And if I make that the central fact of my life, I will be all right. Things around me may not be all right, but I will be all right. That's been my experience in Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's what I want to offer to the newcomer. Get right into the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, it talks about in chapter 4 of our book, the ancient theory of the flat earth. And in some respects, the AA world is a flat earth. If you go to the age of Alcoholics Anonymous, you go off. Don't do that. We have a disease that tells us we're unique, we're different. Nobody understands us. It wants us disconnected. It wants us removed. Ignore all that. Don't go to the edge. Stay right in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. And I like what it actually says in the big book about the doctor's opinion. It says about us why I drank because I liked the effect produced by alcohol. I liked it. I took that first drink, and you've heard the different metaphors. My life went from black and white to color in one drink. The perpetual stone in my shoe was removed. The knot came out of my stomach. For the first time in my life, my skin actually fitted. I could be everything I thought you wanted me to be. And for a chronic people pleaser with low self-esteem, it was a magic elixir. But it was a Faustian bargain. I made a deal with the devil. Booze will give you a lift. But when it came time to pay the freight, oh my goodness. In the Merchant of Venice, Shylock just wanted 1 pound of flesh, not this disease. It'll take your job, your car, your wife, the shirt off your back. But what it really wants is me 6 feet under. There's a lot of terminal diseases out there. I'm not familiar with those, but I'm familiar with this one. This disease, alcoholism, will kill me stone dead with or without a drink in my body. I don't need booze in my body to burn my life to the ground. I almost done it in AA because I wouldn't accept these spiritual principles. I had to accept the fact that there was more wrong with me than drink, and it was going to take more than not drinking to get me well in Alcoholics Anonymous. So if you're new, please stay here with us. And that roller coaster goes up, and the roller coaster goes down. Just don't get off. Stay on. I know we throw the word miracle around a lot in AA, but I don't think it's ubiquitous or overused. And this is not a sales pitch or podium talk, but for those people that are new, I believe there's a miracle here with your name on it. Nobody can take it for you, and nobody can take it from you. Come up and live the life you were meant to live before drink took you down a different road. George Eliot says, it's never too late to live the life you're meant to live. And that's been my experience in Alcoholics Anonymous. I went from an unlived life to a life well lived in Alcoholics Anonymous. And the definition of miracle I like the best is the complete reversal or upheaval of the laws of nature. It's in my nature to be lying drunk somewhere tonight, and I'm not. Now, how did that happen? It didn't happen because of me. It happened because of Alcoholics Anonymous. This is the last thing I tried and the first thing ever worked. So please stay here with us, you know. So I took that first drink, as I said, 14 or 15 years of age back in Northern Ireland. And, you know, I've heard people tell different stories from, you know, that had some success or even a modicum of success. That's not my story. I come out of the starting blocks flat on my face. Within 3 months, and getting my stomach pumped out on a school night. My parents didn't know what to do with me, and I'm blaming where I lived, Northern Ireland, that time with the troubles and like a low-level civil war going on. I was a working-class Catholic from the wrong side of the tracks. Said, I can't get a break. Big chip on my shoulder. In fact, when I got to AA, a guy says to me, you know something, you're a well-balanced guy. And I thought, finally, somebody that knows what's going on around here. He says, yes, you got a chip on both shoulders, hitting everything. It's hard telling jokes on Zoom, right? You know what I'm saying? It's like telling jokes in the graveyard at midnight. You're not really sure if anybody's laughing, you know? But he said, you got a chip on both shoulders. And that was so true, you know? So I'm blaming Northern Ireland, can't get a break. See, that's the story of my life. I'm always looking for an outside fix for an inside job. And you get to Alcoholics Anonymous, AA 101, the first 90 days, you find out it's the inside. I thought if I can just get the right job and the right country, the right continent, for goodness sake, if I just get things lined up out here, once again at the cart before the horse. So I'm blaming Northern Ireland. I said to my father, you know, I said, sit down one night, and I said, I got some bad news for you. He says, what is it? I said, I'm going to America, and don't try and talk me out of it. He says, talk you out of it, I'll help you pack. When on you go, Columbus, you know what I mean? Like, let me give you some fatherly advice. Turn left at Greenland, you know? So off I went to America, and, you know, it was different. It was worse, because the first thing I packed out of the case was me and my alcoholism. I ended up living in a place called Rockaway Beach here in New York. Now, Rockaway Beach, it's a big Irish-American neighborhood, you know? And people have said, not even people in AA, they'll go, oh, Rockaway Beach, the Irish Riviera. What it really should have been called is cirrhosis by the sea. There's more alcoholics per square foot in this town. There's two types of people in this town, those in AA and those that should be in AA. There's a couple of undecideds, but they're just too drunk to make their mind up, you know? And to make matters worse, I got a job as a bartender. I was the worst bartender in the worst bar in Rockaway Beach, and there was some pretty stiff competition. I worked in a bar. We had a bouncer on the door, but he was there to throw people into the bar, not throw them out, you know? I mean, this bar had it all. Alcoholics, drug addicts, degenerate gamblers, and that was just the staff. That wasn't even the customers, you know? And forget about the women. I mean, ladies' night, most of the women that come into that bar look like they put their makeup on when they were jumping up and down on a trampoline. You know what I mean? It's like over here and it's back over here and it's back over here. But water finds its own level and so do alcoholics, and I fit it in like a glove. I'm not going to go into the whole ins and outs, but I've experienced it before my drinking. I was a weekend drinker, a daily drinker, a morning drinking. I'm in this bar. I used to work from 6 at night to 4 in the morning. I'm drinking before I go to work. I'm drinking at work. I mean, it's pretty pathetic. At the end of my drinking, I worked in a bar where I could literally walk behind the stick at 6 o'clock at night and pour myself a drink. At the end of my drinking, I couldn't even get there. Fears and phobias and hang-ups and riding elevators. Forget about the subway. What's the old saying in AA? Booze give me the wings to fly, and then it took away the sky, you know. And by the time I'm 27, I have my first alcoholic seizure, and I wake up in a hospital, and that wouldn't be the last time I'd be in hospital, you know. And here, and Clance used to say this, it's the ironic thing, the worst years of my drinking, I hope they were the worst, 27 to 30, were after I made a firm conviction not to drink anymore. But you see, here's the thing. Until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had nothing between me and the first drink. Up until this moment in time tonight, I single-handedly have never beaten an obsession to drink. And I've got into the ring many times. It's like getting into the ring with a heavyweight champion. My little two-year-old daughter could say, hey, don't get in the ring. But don't get in the ring means don't take the first drink. And I don't know how not to take the first drink. And I keep back getting back in the ring. Perhaps you can identify, and I tell myself the epitaph of the alcoholic. It'll be different this time. I'll watch it. I'll stay off the ropes. See, what I don't realize, the fight is fixed. Alcoholism is sitting in the opposing corner, just like the old cartoons, with a horseshoe in each glove, saying, you want to go again? Let's go. What do you got there? Willpower? Let's go. I'll see you in the middle. And I walk in, bang, haymaker. I'm lying, looking up at the lights, wondering how did this happen again. I cannot thank Alcoholics Anonymous enough for giving me something between me and the first drink. People have said, oh, you're just an arm's length away from a drink. And I suppose technically that's true. Right here, right now. I don't know about tomorrow. God hasn't created it yet. It's none of my business. But right here, right now, I'm 12 steps away from a drink. And that's a long way from when I first walked into AA. But don't get me wrong. They're not 12 steps up to anything. They're 12 steps down to humility. I seen people drink again in AA that I thought would never drink again. And that tells me it's a daily reprieve, not a pardon. And there's certain things I must do if I want to enjoy this way of life. And the only way that I coast in Alcoholics Anonymous is downhill. And I would be in and out of hospitals for the next 2 or 3 years. and I would vow I'd come out of a hospital and, you know, I remember coming out of a hospital one time and telling people, that's it, I'm done. I was drinking 2 hours later after leaving the hospital. As Bill Wilson says, a lunacy commission should be appointed. I love that moment when someone's telling their story, it goes down and it goes down and it goes down, and then they say the most beautiful words in an AA qualification. And then, everybody in here, whether you're sober 24 hours or what, has had an and then moment. And mine was, I'm sitting on a bad drunk at this stage of my drinking. I was a shut-in. You know, I would just, barroom drinking was a memory. I'd just, like, using the old Godfather line, I'd go to the mattresses, I'd lock myself in the apartment and drink, and a note come under the door, and I'd been saying, the note said what I've been hearing since I was 15. You're a nice guy, but you drink too much. And it has two men's telephone numbers on it from the old South Bronx group here in New York. And that group had a mantra, we don't give up on anybody. And they came to my apartment. I didn't go to the Barry, but I brought the Barry to me. And they came to me. I'm on the tail end of this drunk. And I thought they were going to talk about my drinking, because that's all anybody was left in my life. That's what they wanted to talk about. Hey, Paul, we got to talk about your drinking. But the ironic thing, they talked about their drinking, and they told story after story of their drinking. And then the magic happened, our most prized possession, identification. They talked about them, and I found out about me. And just like that classic man in the bed, I put my head in my hands and I said to the guy, I can't live one more day like this. And he says, well, this is your lucky day, my friend, because you don't have to live this way anymore. And about 36 hours later, I got bookended into a car and got brought to a meeting about 2 miles here. And walking in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous is the greatest singular event in my life. Everything else is secondary and tertiary. And I can't tell you one word that was said at that meeting. But I had a feeling when I left that meeting. I had this feeling. I didn't know what it was that night, but I know tonight what it was. It was hope. That's what Alcoholics Anonymous is. AA is hope in human form. People get people sober. God works through people. And the spiritual conduit that he uses to spread his love and grace is the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. If I'm doing AA alone, I'm doing something, but it's not Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's what I felt that night. I'm so glad there wasn't a guy standing at the door with a clipboard saying, check the box for what you want. I would have checked the box for not drinking. I would have been delighted with that. And I was shortchanged myself. Because the things that AA gave me, I didn't even know that they existed that night. I didn't even know. I couldn't comprehend them. And that's the beautiful thing about Alcoholics Anonymous. My sponsor says, the first half of the first step tells you the problem, and then we immediately get into the solution. The whole program is front-loaded on the solution. If I wrote the steps, it'd be 11 and a half steps about drinking and a half a step about the solution. But thank God the first 100 men and women were a lot more spiritually aware than I am. And the last few minutes here, I'd like to tell you that I took the ball and scored a touchdown. I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, as says in their book, let go absolutely of all your old ideas. And I brought a lot of old ideas into AA. Barroom mentality. Barroom mentality that might serve me well in some New York gin mill at 2 o'clock in the morning, but weren't helping me in Alcoholics Anonymous. We talk about the three parts of the triangle, unity, service, and recovery. I was doing unity. I was going to plenty of meetings. Service. I said, I'm making more coffee than Maxwell House, but I wouldn't do recovery. Irish, stoic, don't tell nobody nothing. Robert Frost says a wall is a good thing. Maybe if you're a New England farmer, but not if you're an alcoholic. And I built these walls high and I built them deep. You weren't getting in, but I wasn't getting out. And you can fool them at the coffee pot, but you can't fool them. You know, an untreated alcoholism would come to visit me 2 o'clock in the morning with the could-haves and the should-haves and the would-haves and the guilt and the shame and remorse. And there's a book that would appear at my bedside table every night. Where I Should Be in My Life by Now by Paul McQuaid. Start reading that thing at 3 o'clock in the morning. See, I looked at this program from the wrong direction. I looked at the steps. I looked at the steps. I thought there were information. I'm an alcoholic. I need God. I should take an inventory, defects. You know, I looked at them as information. I realized tonight, thank God I found out, that the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, they're not informative. They're transformative. You go through those steps willingly or kicking and screaming. You're a different person at step 12 than you were at step 1, whether you want to be or not. Having had, I used to think she got it, but he didn't. Nobody gets left behind. God's grace is like the rain that falls on everybody in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I bottomed out at 2.5 years sober. I didn't drink, but it was a jumping off place for the second time. And against my better judgment, in fact, everything that's helped me in AA has been against my better judgment, I put pen to paper. And I realized tonight that we don't do the steps because they're nice. We do them for they're necessary for recovery. If I want to get physically and mentally and spiritually and emotionally rehabilitated, I have to work this program. I've tried every other way of getting the vital spiritual experience, some symbolic victories, but nothing of any permanence. It's a God-shaped hole, and only God with the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous can fill it. And why is it important to go through those steps? Is it nice to get a to find out who you are and who you're not and get a full knowledge of your condition? Yeah. But when did my life catch on fire? When I turned around and tried to help another man. And Bill Wilson got that even before he left the hospital, in Towns Hospital. He asked Dr. Silkworth, can I talk to other patients? We didn't have a 12th step, but he realized, I wonder by talking to you, will I be able to help me? It's the foundation stone of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's so true in my life today. Even this Zoom world, I got to find some way of doing 12-step work. If I'm not doing the 12th step, I'm working an 11-step program. An 11-step program for a guy like me is nothing more than a self-help program. It's a highly evolved self-help program, but it's all about me. The 12th step completes that spiritual circuit. Without you, eventually there will be no me, you know. And as I said there, I thought I'd come into Alcoholics Anonymous and work this program. And I'd walk between the raindrops, but things happen. Alcoholics Anonymous didn't give me immunity from life. It gave me the ability to do what I could never do, which is life on life's terms. I couldn't do that. To show up for life. Life would knock on the front door and I would get a bottle of vodka and climb out the back window. Oh, I would dress it up. I'm a free spirit. I'm a rebel. You can't put a label on me. But I was a devout coward when it came to life on life's terms. And life is not easy. But now when life knocks on the door, I've got a program, I've got a sponsor, I've got a higher power, I've got unity, service, recovery, these wonderful people. I can open the door and say to life, yes, what is it? I'm not climbing out the back window anymore. And you know what Alcoholics Anonymous has given me that I can't repay them back for? My life has got meaning today. I'm not sitting in some bar at 3 o'clock in the morning wondering what it's about. I know what it's about. My life has got meaning today. Life is hard. Without meaning, it's almost unbearable. And my life has got meaning today. You know, and I think to myself, you know, at the end of my drinking, I would sit, it was like a shut-in, and I'd be sitting there drinking around the clock, and as Bill Wilson, probably that maudlin depression, and I'd look out the window and I'd see my people going to work and coming home from work, and I'd wonder, how do they do it? And I remember sitting there putting the bottle to my lips and I'm thinking to myself, what the hell happened to me? How did it ever get this bad? What happened to that young kid that loved nothing more than to run out in the morning with a soccer ball under his arm and play soccer all day? What happened to him? And I'm not drinking for any fun or frivolity. I'm drinking for unconscious time. My life is so unbearable. I think to myself, if I can just keep enough of this vodka down my neck, maybe I can pass out for a couple of hours and the pain will just go away for a couple of hours. That's what you'd have seen if you'd have come to my apartment in August of 1992. You come to my apartment today, you won't see death happening. You'll see life happening. Now, if you're looking for a perfect life, go to the house next door. But you'll see life happening here today. Teenage kids, young baby, worries about finances, this, that, the other. But there's life happening here today. That's not the way it was in August of 1992, at the end of my drinking. It's a terrible way to live. It was almost like you're in a car that's spinning out of control and you reach for the steering wheel and there is none. Man, I don't want to live that way anymore, you know. And as I said there, I lie in my bed sometimes and in the depths of a dream, and that young boy will run to me. That 8-year-old boy with the ball, with the soccer ball under his arm, will run to me. And I'll put my arm around him and I'll say, it's all right. Don't worry. I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I got sober. I met these beautiful people in Alcoholics Anonymous. I got a program that works under all conditions. Don't worry. Everything is going to be all right, you know. And that's because of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I think to myself, what's the old Oscar Wilde line? I knew the price of everything and the value of nothing. Alcoholics Anonymous has shown me things of great value, of what's really important in the hierarchy of life, you know. I was going out this morning there. My wife's a big coffee drinker, and I went out this morning at 6:30. And I went through a divorce, talking about things being up and down and whatnot. I went through a divorce at 20 years sober that almost put my head away. Resentment to here, how about up to here? Another man involved, it had been going on for years. And I remember saying to myself, and thank God, you know, it'll get a guy like me in trouble when you're sober in AA for a while. Spiritual pride. How can I go to my home group and tell them that my life's falling apart right in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous? But that's what I had to do. I didn't have to do a PowerPoint presentation, but Alcoholics Anonymous is a reality check on how my life is going today. Not how I think it should go or I want to go. How's the rubber meeting the road in my life today? And I remember getting asked to speak at a meeting, and I said to my sponsor, I'm not going to speak at a meeting. He says, why not? I said, who wants to hear what I have to say? I'm 20 years sober, and my wife's leaving me for another guy, and my 9-year-old daughter's crying herself to sleep at night saying, Daddy, I don't want to get divorced. Who the hell wants to hear that message? And he says, Paul, that's what you go out. What do you think this is, rainbows and unicorns? You go out and you tell the people how you're trying to practice these principles in all your affairs, even your wife's affair. You go out and tell people that. And that's what I did in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I had to forgive people. I said, Clarence used to say, it's easy to do the things you want to do in Alcoholics Anonymous. I got sober and got free doing things I didn't want to do, or more importantly, doing things I didn't believe in. Praying for people. I said, I'm not praying for that guy. But I had to. You see, I found out the hard way in Alcoholics Anonymous. I would never try to cheat. I believe there's spiritual laws to the universe, just like there's physical laws to the universe. And I would never try to cheat, say, the physical law of gravity. Let me step out the second floor window and not use the stairs today. I'd never do that. But I tried to cheat the spiritual laws of this universe. I'm not going to forgive that guy. I'll forgive him this much. But that's what I had to do in Alcoholics Anonymous. I had to do things I didn't want to do, do things I didn't want to believe in, because I wanted to be free. There's an old saying in Alcoholics Anonymous, how free do you want to be? And that's what I did at 20 years sober. So this idea, and I remember saying to God, what are you doing, God? I'm a good boy in AA. I'm going to meetings. I'm doing everything they say. I'm eating my vegetables. This shouldn't be happening to me. But guess what? It did happen. And Alcoholics Anonymous, as I said, didn't give me immunity from life. It gave me the ability to show up for life one day at a time. And I think about myself. I said, this morning, it's funny how things happen. that's 8 years ago, and she married that guy, and they're happy, and I'm happy for them. I got remarried, and I got a two-year-old daughter. But this morning, I was going to get my wife coffee this morning at 6:30. And my daughter, my ex-wife, lives about five blocks from me. That's the 5 minute. We live about five blocks from each other. So I'm in the dark here at 6:30. I'm coming to the coffee shop, and I hear this voice saying, "Daddy, Daddy, Daddy." And it was my teenage daughter. She was staying with her mother last night. It's 6:30 in the morning, and she's running down the street and threw her arms around me and gave me a big hug. Because she saw me, like, we didn't expect to see each other, you know, one of the unexpected things. And she's hugging me. And she only saw me the day before. I thought to myself, there's a guy in Brooklyn used to say, great guy, there's no end to the good in Alcoholics Anonymous. I thought to myself, you know, that's what Alcoholics Anonymous has taught me. The things of real value. That daughter of mine hugging me this morning and going off. I said, what are you doing? She goes, I'm getting coffee for Mom. She's going to drive me to school today. And I pulled up in the car, and my ex-wife was sitting there. This is a woman, as I said, speak to her. I'm not going to look at her again. But because of Alcoholics Anonymous, as our founder, acting better than you feel, taking actions I didn't want to believe in, I rolled down the window and I said, hey, how you doing? I says, you know, it's expensive driving her to school. She wants coffee. She wants this. And she laughed. And I went on about my day. Freedom. Freedom. And Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm not carrying. I walked around most of my life dragging. I'm not doing that today. I wore life like a loose garment. I run around with a few guys who were sober a while. And they said to me, Paul, you're a real squeaky wheel. I said, that's right. If you're in my life, you know what's going on. The old legend of Bluebeard, you remember? You're allowed to go anywhere in this house, but there was one room you weren't allowed to go into. And you know it was in that one room, you're right, all the ills of the world. I can't have a one room. I got to be open. I got to be transparent. I got to have somebody in my life. I don't care how long you're in Alcoholics Anonymous. I got to talk to my sponsor on a regular basis. What's the old saying in AA? When you're inside the jar, you can't read the label. I need somebody standing outside the jar who's not as emotionally attached to my life as I am, who can see the wood for the trees, who can say, Paul, it may appear that way, but this is what I think's really going on. As I said there, I said, I bartended the last 5 years drinking, and I bartended the first 12 years in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'll tell you something you probably know. Most alcoholics die drunk. They don't even darken the door of an AA meeting. Now, why am I sitting here tonight? Thank God Alcoholics Anonymous is not a meritocracy by where your good deeds out there drinking ensured you have a place in here, or you'd have a different speaker, and that's not false humility. I don't know why I'm sober and the guy two stools down drank himself to death. I could have sent the Pentagon. I don't have security clearance for that information. It's above my pay grade. But I know what I must do. There was somebody at the door for me. I got to be at the door for somebody else. For that, I am responsible. And I think to myself, that I said, Clancy with the golden memories, that little girl that hugged me this morning, I remember when she was about 3 years of age, and we were up in Maine, and it was the end of August, and there was a little amusement park. It was our first time ever in an amusement park. And there was a little Ferris wheel for children. I squeezed on next to her. We're going around this little Ferris wheel. And it was a beautiful New England day. Just a hint of fall in the air. And azure blue sky. And we're going around. You know how children are. Totally unsolicited. Totally unfettered. She puts her hands up in the air like this. And she says, Daddy, this is the greatest day of my life. And I love you so much. And I thought to myself, my heart almost burst. I said, that's what I was looking for in whiskey. That feeling, but I found it in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I thank you for that. I want to end on a few words that sums up how I feel about you and Alcoholics Anonymous. It's the Irish blessing. May the road rise to meet you. May the wind be always at your back. May the sun shine warm upon your face and the rains fall soft upon your fields. And until we meet again, may God hold you in the palm of his hand. Thank you so much, everyone. Thank you.
Celebrate AA birthdays at this meeting. We define sobriety as freedom from alcohol, pills, pot, or anything that would affect you from the neck up. If you're a regular attendee of this meeting and would like to take a cake with us, please email our scribe, Ann P., at birthdays@pacificgroupla.org.
Hi, everybody. My name's Ann. I'm an alcoholic. Don't forget your sponsor's name. Thank
you. Please email her by 6:30. Otherwise, you have to wait till the following week to get recognized. We have several birthdays tonight. And tonight, we've asked a special guest to come out and sing us happy birthday to our recipients.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, happy birthday, happy birthday to you. Keep coming back.
Yeah, man. And our birthdays tonight are our first birthday is for Dong K for 1 year, sponsored by Rich B. Our second birthday is for 4 years for Rob B, sponsored by Eddie S. The next birthday is for Dave W for 24 years, sponsored by Steve W. Next birthday is for Cynthia P for 32 years, sponsored by Marlena B. Next birthday is for Katya A for 32 years, sponsored by Paula P. Next birthday is Linda W for 35 years, sponsored by Sharon C. Next birthday is for Tina A for 38 years, sponsored by Sharon C. Next birthday is for Zach H for 38 years, sponsored by Clancy I. Next birthday is for Danny S. for 41 years, sponsored by Paul C. So that was 9 birthdays for a total of 244 years, the average of 21.11 years. Happy birthday, all the recipients. Okay. We have a custom at the Pacific Group of donating $1 for each candle on your birthday cake. At the end of the year, this is candle money is our contributions to AA organizations worldwide. If you wish to participate in this custom, please email our treasurer, Betty H, at treasurer@pacificgroupla.org. Underneath.